This is the Taylor Report at the CIUT 89.5 FM. To get us started on the subject of the Gaza matter, I think we have queued up something, and I'll just say by way of introduction, again, this is a dramatic moment in labor history in the United States, which tends to reverberate here. The United Auto Workers, who have just established themselves through strikes, really dramatic strikes, powerful strikes, as once again a living, breathing representative of organized labor, prepared to challenge the famous Big Three. And so they follow that now by making the announcement that as a union, they're calling for a ceasefire, and we're going to let you hear that announcement from in front of the White House.
Has voted to join the call for a ceasefire. Yeah! The UAW International is calling for an immediate, permanent ceasefire in Israel.
Why did God?
The UAW International has voted to join the call for a ceasefire. The UAW International is calling for an immediate, permanent ceasefire in Israel and Palestine so that we can get to the work of building a lasting peace, building social justice, and building a community, a global community of solidarity. That is what we've committed ourselves to, and that is as important as anything else that we're doing in this country in order to assure that workers and oppressed people and poor people across the world are on the path to winning the justice they so deserve. So I'm here with you all. I'm proud to stand with our fellow union members from the postal workers, from UE. For so long, we've been silent and we've been ignorant in the labor movement to this issue. And that time is over. And I want to thank all the rank and file members who have made this happen.
And that is, I have his name in front of me, Brandon Mancilla. And he is, Phil, I think you told me he's based in Buffalo.
Yeah, that's right. He's District 9A of the United Auto Workers, headquartered in Buffalo, New York.
And the president himself, Sean Fain, has also spoken. Am I right?
That's right. And he's endorsed this statement. I mean, as Mancilla made clear, he was speaking for the union that day. He wasn't just speaking for himself or his district.
Right? Yes. Now, this is big stuff.
This is very big
stuff. And let's credit Unifor, auto workers in Canada, represents the auto workers in Canada, has also taken a stand on this point, calling, I believe, roughly the same language. And we have to keep score now, and we also have to call this for a fact. This is dramatic news that labor movement, but particularly in the United States, has one significant union. It's kind of like mentioned, there are unions that are kind of legendary. There's Teamsters. You say, Teamsters said, ooh, people pay attention. Longshoremen, UE. These are unions that are leaders. But frankly, we have a thing called the Cold War, and labor has been broken up and demoralized by attacks on their right to speak out and to represent the members, and particularly the opinions of the members. That has been crushed. And the greatest example of it is the AFL-CIO. Some people think it should be, they left out three letters, AFL-CIO-CIA. They will punish you if you try to speak out. UAW is not a member of the AFL-CIO, and which is one reason. He cited, and I didn't hear it there, but it was more to his remarks. He cited as a predecessor to this phenomena the Walter Reuther opposing the Vietnam War in 1968, which precipitated quite a bit of, I would say, political activity. It emboldened, gave courage to others. But as you know, the enemies of freedom use fear. And, you know, when people speak up and like the UAW, it will give courage to others. Courage is infectious. But CIO is something that we need to talk about more, because while these unions, UE, he said postal workers, have spoken up, the function of the AFL-CIO has been to control workers, hold them down, and make sure they don't say things. On this show, Tony Leah, we hope to be speaking, he's with Unifor, as you know. He was going to, he'll be with us probably next week. There's been other dramatic developments we want to ask him about it, with developments with the UAW. But one of the things he pointed out in a previous show was that there was a local in Tacoma, Washington, I believe, where the members had voted solidarity with the Palestinian people in the issue on the matter of recognition of two-state solution, et cetera. And that when that local prepared to either vote, or no, it had voted. I think they were going to make it public or whatever. But they were told by the FL-CIO representative in the region that they cannot do that, that the FL-CIO would throw them out or put them under sanction if they were to say anything. So the FL-CIO-CIA controls American labor. Unfortunately, we have to say, the same is true, seems to be true here. The CLC, Phil, the Canadian Labor Congress, has not said anything on this issue. They did not call for a ceasefire. Are you aware of that?
I am aware of that. And as you know, I attended the Ontario Federation of Labor Convention last week. And although there were some promising signs, that issue never got to the floor.
Yeah,
which means that, of course, they didn't refuse to call for a ceasefire. They just didn't talk about it. You know?
Yeah, that is very striking, actually. And I hope let's call it a misunderstanding. Yeah. Let's hope. I think that you pointed out that the individual were elected to secretary position.
Oh, Secretary Treasurer, absolutely. He's re-elected to the position, Mr. Ahmed Gayad. He is from the United Food and Commercial Workers, which is the largest purely private sector union in the OFL. And a member of that union is the president of the CLC. Mr. Gayad gave his report to the delegates, and of course, as a secretary treasurer, he's giving a very technical report, you know, about budgets, the headquarters office and stuff like that. And then he says, but I can't finish my report without talking about that issue, which is near and dear to me. And of course, he's wearing a Palestinian flag lapel pin while he's speaking. So people understood what the subject was. And then he gave an inspired talk, and he said, you can't be a trade unionist and believe in solidarity and be quiet when you see what is being done to the people in Gaza. And he got a thumping ovation, right? Now, there were a...
You can repeat that.
A thumping ovation.
Thumping ovation.
Traditionally, the delegates vote to accept the report of the officers, and they always vote unanimously. But there were four or five folks in the hall who refused to accept his report. And I thought, okay, well, that's good. I'm glad that they pushed the issue, because we could all see how few of them there were, right?
That's true. They wanted to advertise how little they represented. That's very
right.
Touching.
Yeah. That was a very, very inspiring moment. I was introduced to him afterwards, and I thanked him for, you know, his efforts, and he said, well, that's who I am. You know? Who he is, he says he identifies as a trade unionist, as a Canadian, and as a Libyan Canadian.
No, he's Libyan.
He's a Libyan Canadian. And he's a...
Does Hillary Clinton know where he lives?
Oh, my goodness. Watch out for that Hillary. And he is a he's a grocery clerk from No Frills. That's where he began his union career as a teenager. He became a shop steward when he was like 18 or 19 years old. He's not yet 40 years old. And he really... impresses tremendously.
Well, I'm really glad you tell that. It strikes me that it might have been some type of, we're speculating, maybe it's bureaucratic oversight or something, right. But we really, these labor bodies, right. As you said, thundering support, so right. They were ready.
Those delegates were
all
ready.
All they needed was a resolution. That's they would right. have voted for it.
And they didn't get it.
They now, did. Yeah. They did give, when the name Sarahjama, I think you tell me,
yes.
was mentioned, they seemed to be rather enthusiastic. You want yes. to tell that story?
Well, yes. All of the delegates from Hamilton who were led by the Hamilton District Labor Council, which is a component of the Ontario Federation of Labor and takes in most of the union locals in the Hamilton area, they presented an emergency resolution which did not pass because you needed 2/3 of vote to get it on the floor, and it was censuring the NDP for...
Yes.
Now, I thought that their emergency resolution was an overreach, and
it seemed to be designed to lose.
Yeah, it was. That's what I thought. I thought it was designed to lose.
But her name came up.
Her name came up, and to cheers. I mean, it is my hope, and I tell this to all the NDP people that I talk to, that whatever happened between you and Sarahjama is repairable. She's still a member of the legislature. You're still the official opposition. You need to all sit down, like big people, not like children, like big people, yes. and settle your differences, because I think that's very important. The NDP just lost a by-election.
Don't hold your breath.
Oh, yeah. The NDP just lost a by-election of a seat that they had held in Kitchener.
Got cleaned.
And they did. And the Kitchener, Riding Association in Kitchener, had walked out on the party in support of Sarahjama. I'm not sure that's the right thing to do, but that's what they did, you know.
Yeah. Well, it is very telling, but that particularly on the labor front, the spirit of it, because this is where, you know, where something is going outside of particular movements or organizations right. that impact.
Yeah. By the way, the federal MP for Hamilton, Mr. Green, came to the microphone, so he must have had a delegate's badge. A delegate who loaned him his credentials, and he spoke in support of Sarahjama and the NDP. Having her within their ranks, and he's a federal MP, right?
Yes. So. If you haven't seen it, go to his Twitter account where he is. He has some resolution, or he's speaking at any rate, and he's wearing a keffiyeh.
Yeah. Okay.
Did you see that?
I didn't see that, but I'm not surprised.
Holding an upraised fist, yeah. and you say, "Is that the Canadian Parliament I know? The one that votes like a zombie?" It, you know, where you just say, you know, click on foreign policy, click, click, everybody's on. But this one is some kind of headache. By the way, Phil, and again, listeners, this is the Taylor Report, and this is a good time to announce, what is this event coming up? The time, date, and place first, if you would.
Well, the time, date, and place, this is a film called Israelism, and the time, place, and date is... December the 6th, which is on Wednesday at 7 p.m. at the Westdale Theater in Hamilton. And the description is, when two young American Jews raised to unconditionally love Israel witness the brutal way Israel treats Palestinians, their lives take sharp left turns. Now, this is an Israeli filmmaker. This is an Israeli film. The theater, which is associated, I believe, with, I can't say that. I don't know. Maybe it's an independent theater. I was going to say associated with McMaster, but it doesn't seem to be. No. But anyway, the theater owner just accepted the booking weeks ago and then just canceled it. And then the Independent Jewish Voices showed up and picketed the theater, and they uncanceled the cancellation. That it must be independently owned, because if it was owned by McMaster, they would double down on their stubbornness.
There's a lot of talk about this film.
Yeah.
The title of the film again?
Israelism.
And it's going to be shown where?
Wednesday, 7 p.m. at the Westdale Theater in Hamilton. And the filmmakers will be there.
The Israeli filmmaker will be present.
It's singular. The filmmaker will be present for a question and answer.
We're going to take a firm position in the Taylor Report. We're against canceling these films. Anybody's film, frankly. I don't care. Yeah. I agree with Bertrand Russell's great line. You know, they tell us we're free, and you have your freedom until you need it, and then you don't have it. And he went to jail as living proof.
Yeah. Well, and of course, the contemporary of that is Facebook and Twitter sometimes, and Instagram take away your freedom of speech, which they assure you that you have.
You have.
But then, of course, you say something about
something.
Something, and then they say, oh, you
guess,
know what?
Guess what it is.
Yeah, yeah. They don't even this tell you exactly.
There's three tickets to hell for the
you didn't meet community standards, but they didn't tell you which posting you made.
The community standards is between the ears of that censor.
Yeah.
You know, he knows. He puts his finger up and he thinks in the wind and thinks, what does the boss want? And turns out that's community standard.
Yeah. That's a good definition.
I think that's close.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, if you ask the guy himself, he'd say yes, because he's, you know, he embodies America. Yeah. So this is the Taylor Report. I'm really glad that you've announced that. It keeps us right on this issue of understanding what's going on. My complaint is this. I want to understand why the Canadian government uses, certainly in the early going, I haven't actually heard them say it again recently. Sometimes they get into slogans and then they drop them. And so they haven't really been pounding the drums about we stand with Israel, but they do. And members of parliament have gone over and visited. And I want to quote to you the words of the Prime Minister of Israel. And they are, you must remember what Amalek has done to you, says our Holy Bible. This is the Prime Minister, who's actually not known for his orthodoxy. You must remember what Amalek has done to you, says our Holy Bible. And that's Benjamin Netanyahu. And then he says, we do remember. And we are fighting. That's the lines. Go on, you know, just check it out. So here's what the Holy Bible said to do to Amalek. Now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all they have and spare them not, but slay them, both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel, and ass. That was the Prime Minister. I watched him say this. So why does our Prime Minister maintain relations with this? Because this is a call for murder. This is an unadulterated call for murder. That isn't a state. That's not a document. That's nothing from the United Nations Charter. It's not from a democratic constitution. It's not a. It is not diplomacy. It is raw advocacy, and it's put in this form. So I want to know why wasn't there a word from the Prime Minister saying that language of that kind is unacceptable? You know, the Prime Minister and those around him, and even our mayor and others like to say, that is unacceptable. Well, what I just read to you about Amalek, and it's not me, it's Benjamin Netanyahu who said it. Why can't we send him a message and just say, that's not acceptable? And why are we cooperating and providing any kind of rationalization? It's one thing to say, if you have a government that says it's following the laws or our values is, Minister Freeland likes to say, our values. Those, as far as I know, now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all they have and spare them not. I don't think those are our values, see. I may be mistaken. I think about Chrystia Freeland. She now leaves the door open because she didn't say nothing here. And neither did the Prime Minister. So I guess the door is open on our values because I want to remind you, there's nothing in the UN Charter, there's nothing in international law that permits that kind of talk. That is incitement, clear, bloody incitement. And when you have a minister of defense and he says, we're going to deny them food and water. Food and water, we're going to deny them that to them. You have to say, do we have anything to say about that? Or do we have a government? The response of the guy who's actually got the power, Joe Biden, is to say they have a right to defend themselves. Actually, there's not a being on earth that doesn't have a right to defend himself. And so there's a word we need to use more, and that's indivisible. Both sides have an indivisible right to peace. And it's not only one side gets to have it. And the way you get to have your peace is to guarantee peace for the other side. It's indivisible. When you say, I'm doing this for my self-defense, your opponent, she, they, also have that right. And it's indivisible. So you have to say, you too have the right to defend yourself. Another helpful thing I think we could say, and I wish more people would, and this crisis has brought it really to the light, and that is that Palestine is a state. More countries around the globe recognize the state of Palestine, state, S-T-A-T-E. More countries around the world recognize the state of Palestine than recognize Israel. I hate to shock the Christian Zionists of North Carolina, but that's a fact. And we have to remind people. Recently, the woman representing the Palestinians was given an opportunity to speak to the Security Council. They are observers at the United Nations, and so she has that status. They are not. She pointed out we are a state. It has not been made a full member of the UN, but that doesn't mean it's not a state. It is a state. And people like to throw around this strange language. Oh, it's the Palestinian Authority. Frankly, the Palestinian Authority is not, as we all understand, is not the most credible group because their funding comes via Washington. I remind you, George Bush is the boss of the region, the boss. The money for the Palestinian Authority comes to them from the U.S., and it passes through the hands of Israel, also has say over the money getting to the so-called authority. But on the matter of a state, it is recognized as a state. And we ought to upgrade Canada's relations with it. I would put a price tag on it for Israel if they don't like that and say, you stop using what Netanyahu calls our Holy Bible as a guide to how to treat other countries. And then we'll talk about, you know, these relations. But there has to be more of an onus put on people talking this way. And we ought to be saying, we have a minimal under contact in, with the Palestinian state, but we ought to upgrade it. There should be the same level of recognition between the Palestinian state, which exists, and Canada in terms of exchange of diplomats, number of diplomats, and contact. Because what we're showing is an old British and American colonial way of looking at the world through everybody calls the Five Eyes, the white Anglo-Saxon countries. Still regard anybody not of that circle as an underling. And we have to get over that. And one big way would be to clarify and establish this matter of Palestine, the state, with whom we ought to have equal relations. We ought to be talking about more aid to them, as a matter of fact, more help establish a system that isn't dependent on the U.S. and Israel. And there's where the Biden comes in again. Biden is, if you look at it closely, Biden controls the board. Everything on the board in front of him he's got control over it. If you remember, Phil, a couple of weeks ago, when all this bloody attacks began, the accusation was made, well, we're fighting Iran, they said. We're fighting Russia and Iran, when they referred to Hamas. But then they said, well, you know, there are hostages, and we don't want them to be harmed. And any civilized and decent person, to quote Jimmy Carter, decent person, would say, let's first of all remove the hostage issue as an issue. Trade, exchange, which has been done in every war, and as Israel has done it before, as have the PLO and other political representatives of the Palestinians when this issue came up, Lebanon, Hezbollah. So, yes, it can be done. So when they said, okay, well, all right, we're going to do it. We're going to enter negotiations. Then we found out that Iran had nothing to do with any of this, that all the talking was going on in Qatar. And Qatar is a strategic ally. Look it up. I mean, is there anything more authoritative than Wikipedia? Look it up, Wikipedia. Nine out of 10 professors will accept this, that the Qatar is a strategic ally of the United States. The United States has an advanced naval base in Qatar, and they also have Hamas. Hamas has an office, and that's where the negotiations were going on. And as we now learn, they had been talking to each other all along, because, in fact, there's never a war that there is not a back-channel conversation going on about, okay, if we do this, are you going to do the other thing? You know, it's kind of like you see if you can sort it all out before you kill each other. So that's a fact. So Biden had control over that. That's Biden's territory. He also controls Jordan. He also controls Egypt. And, of course, he also controls Israel. Some people have a hard time believing that. It's a fact. Israel was brought into being with the blessing of primarily United States, three parties, really, but the two key parties were United States and Russia. They're the ones who did it. And there has been a strategic investment in Israel by the United States, loads them down with weapons. They even have a military base there. So Biden it's been pointed out, he's an enabler, because he says, well, Israel can defend itself. That is to say, bomb hospitals. There are something like 30 hospitals, and 20 of them have been destroyed. The mosques, the university. There was a university in Gaza City. That's been destroyed. Museums have been destroyed. And of course, the people, 20,000, have been killed, civilians. And Biden says, "Well, you can do that. That's okay, but because you're defending yourself. But you should observe humanitarian guidelines." There's some such lingo. By doing that, he's actually enabling the attack. He's not saying don't do it. He's saying do it, but do it nicely. There's no nice here. They're talking, what today's news indicates, that a project seems to be underway for population transfer. Drive the people out of the population of northern Gaza. Basically, I hate to say it this way, but to drive them into the desert, to drive them into either a more confining space in southern Gaza, which seems to me more likely than going into Egypt, because Egypt, they're trying to keep Egypt from exploding. Egypt is showing signs of reacting. And so it's hard to keep the lid on. If you try to drive them into Egypt, you're going to probably reap a whirlwind. But at any rate, it's once again a variety of what is called a Nakba, where people are told they have to leave and they cannot come back. That's what's going to happen. And Biden is responsible for that. So These are matters that need to be underlined. I have in front of me a book by the man himself, Benjamin Netanyahu, My Story. Bibi, by the way, I didn't know he thought, referred, I knew people called him Bibi. I didn't know he called himself Bibi. So this is Phil's idea of a revelation. Anyhow, he's helped me out here with his, he's got a map at the beginning of the book. And if you can see, Phil, he's got a map of Israel, and there's no West Bank.
No, it's a map of...
There's no Gaza.
No.
And it's his book,
yeah.
So I think that's what he thinks the map is. If you didn't know, he appeared before the General Assembly of the United Nations not that long ago and held up a map, and the map was pretty big. A lot of his neighbors noticed that their territory was included in his territory. Meanwhile, people take any discussion of, for example, you know, from the river, we've talked about on the show before, from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free. That, they don't remember the people who say, oh, Mike, you're calling for the annihilation of the Jewish state. Actually, what they're calling for is, it says freedom. It'll be free, and there's nothing in it that... It's not the greatest slogan, but people have to make up slogans. They usually prefer to rhyme it. So it promises freedom, and it doesn't restrict it. It doesn't say only one group will be free. It says Palestine will be free. And, of course, it used to be Palestine under British authority, and all Muslims, Christians, and Jews were living there under that authority, as they had previously lived under the Ottoman. But on the Taylor Report, we pointed out before that the Likud, which is the political party of Bibi, says from the sea to the river is sovereign Israel. So it's exactly the same proposition, except that it says it's Israel. And so and he, Netanyahu, at the United Nations, held up a map, and literally in front of the General Assembly, held up a map in which there is no West Bank. And, of course, he also is including Syria, which you and I were going to talk about Syria today. At the General Assembly, about 5 days ago, there was a vote on the Golan Heights, which is Syrian territory, recognized as such, not on Bibi's map, but everybody else's map, Syria, Golan Heights. There was a vote to return the Golan Heights to Syria, and 8 countries voted against it. The 8 basically were the United States and Canada, and little things that belong to the United States, like
Nauru and places like that.
Oh, you can say Nauru.
Because what they all have in common is that their population is all going to be drowned by global warming, so they need somebody to take in their population. Okay. So they're trying to be nice to the Australians and the Americans and people like that, and hoping that they'll be merciful.
But by the way, I mean, Canada voted against.
Yes, Canada did.
I don't understand how they rationalize that. It is under all
rational. You want business. Rational? What is this? This is Bob Ray's foreign ministry. Yes, what is rational?
Did he call before he voted? Anyhow, the General Assembly voted for that, to return to the Golan Heights.
By the way, that's a resolution of the Security Council of many years standing, right? Probably 50 years standing.
You can't take territory by war. That's supposedly one of the principles that they all go by. It's shocking. I'll tell you what something I've enjoyed here from Netanyahu. Maybe I will have time, but also mention the two Michaels. But I want to be sure I say that I was reading Benjamin Netanyahu, and I get a kick out of his confidence. He said that Bill Clinton wanted to talk to him, and he knew that Clinton was going to urge him to be a little more flexible on the question of Palestinians. And at the time, Yasser Arafat was involved in the talks. But he said he went to see Clinton, and he knew that Clinton, he said, was going to put pressure on him. So he put pressure, he said, on Clinton. He went a day or two earlier and met with Christian Zionists, including Mr. Hagee, who spoke the other day in Washington. The one who is going to be, I want to say Rhapsody. Well, you know, when they're called up.
He's going to be raptured. Yeah.
Raptured. I got it.
The so Christian Zionist will be raptured.
He's going to be raptured
at
up.
The time of Armageddon. And you're not being included. You don't get raptured, Phil.
Yeah, I'm not even. I don't have any skin in that game. But so he said that Hagee said we're in the last days. This is the time of the apocalypse, and therefore he said we have to double down for support of Israel no matter what. That's him. So Bibi says he met with him and the others, and they told him, never mind Clinton, we got your back. So he said that really irritated Clinton. And you know, here we are, we talk about, everybody says, oh, we hate foreign interference in our internal affairs. He comes to Washington. He calls the Christian Zionists to come and see him, and they all say, we're with you, against the President of the United States. And he did it like you'd give a guy a hot foot. He said, that really made Clinton mad. You want to keep your eye on the Christian Zionists. By the way, also, he affirms that, he said, yeah, people talk about Zionism. We're not the first Zionists. He said the Christians were the first Zionists. And the Americans, he gives credit where credit is due. Again, it's the Taylor Report. It is CIUT. I guess I better just say on the Two Michaels story that please check out the Globe and Mail today, because you'll be able to enter into the ongoing argument of who these guys were or are. But what you learn is that now some diplomats are saying that, yes, there have been personnel functioning as diplomats who overstepped. And so the overstep in this issue is that two Michaels met on the Yalu River, and one Michael was talking to the other Michael about information, and the Michael who asked for the information wrote it in a report that went to the CIA, and the other Michael didn't write the report and claims he didn't know they were going to do that. But if you were Chinese intelligence watching, you would remember that Korean War is not over. There is only a ceasefire, basically, an agreement to hold. So North Korea has developed a nuclear weapon. There are missiles. China has very bad relations, and the United States is talking about recognizing Taiwan and causing all kinds of trouble. So one of these guys is writing a report that goes to the CIA, but he says, well, I sent it to my boss, but he sends it to Five Eyes. And so people should just follow this closely and understand that also, and now we're going to remind everybody that Mr. Kovrig quit his job as a diplomat, stayed in the country, and then represented the International Crisis Group, and is on the payroll. That's, I assume, good money. It says senior, so I guess senior makes more than junior. But it tells us that probably we ought to exercise our right to be skeptical and ask for the facts. And a great show is coming up, Phil.
Tomorrow, Wednesday night at 7 p.m.?
Well, there's that one, but the show following us.
Oh, okay. That's tracks from abroad.
Yeah. I can remember anything about my name when the time is tight. Okay. We're going to thank Riley. We're going to see you next week. Taylor Report.